When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking, and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Ned Bolting.
I'm Laura Laker.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And we are here to decarbonise transport. So in the UK, surface transport is the single largest contributor of greenhouse gases, and it produces 23% of our emissions. We've made basically no significant inroads in cutting that contribution in a decade. But if the last year has taught us anything, aside from how to use Zoom, rapid change is possible when we put our minds to it. So we're talking about transport decarbonisation plans.
Yeah.
Is it the plan we need or the one we deserve?
Oh, this strikes me as quite a big question that you've raised today, Laura. I'm quite intimidated by the scale of this problem.
Well, I think that's the problem, isn't it? I think we're all like, what do we do? Yeah. One person can change anything, but raindrop thaws a cause the waterfall.
Haven't you got to, before you even start to think about how you shift people in a carbon neutral way, haven't you got to start with the biggest question of all, which is why shift people? Like, so what are the journeys that we make and why do we make them? And how many can be replaced with not moving? And is that even something that we want to achieve as a society?
Yeah, I don't think it is, because I think that movement and the freedom of movement, if you like, and being able to is part of human progress. Transport has always been seen as part of human progress. Now there is a line that we've probably crossed now where we're effectively driving to the fridge to try and get, you know, to go and get some milk or whatever. But largely, I think people having access to, obviously, employment, being having access to go and see friends and families, it are all important things. But do we need to do them, you know, slightly less? Or when we do them, often very short journeys, journeys for leisure, for example, you know, how do we go about doing those? So the worrying thing, I think, about all of this plan and the narrative that's been since and before it, is the fact that the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, says that we can still do the same things in slightly different ways and still cut carbon. You know, it's not about stopping people doing things. It's about doing the same things differently, is a quote. We will still fly on holiday, but in more efficient aircraft using sustainable fuel. We will still drive, but increasingly in zero emission cars. And the problem with that is that the experts don't agree. You know, the committee on climate change think that even if all cars are electric, we need to reduce mileage, you know, up around something like 14 to 20%, depending on who you ask and the circumstances. So, and I don't think anyone in aviation really believes, other than people who want to keep flying more, that we're going to have, you know, electric planes that can do long distances at any time ever, possibly, or anytime soon. So I think the technology will bail us out is the biggest problem here, because if we procrastinate and we start thinking and talking about which bit of the technology is going to save us. By the time we realize that it won't, it'll be too late. And that's what keeps me up at night, really.
Yeah, it is a worry. But we have changed quite a lot in the last year. I mean, we stopped traveling, obviously. And although none of that was really up to us, long term, some of those changes have stuck around. So there will be less traveling. But yeah, it's that sort of, we don't need to change, just sounds like someone who doesn't want to upset the likes of the Daily Mail and get bad press. It sounds like someone who's maybe not that committed, because it's interesting. The ambition is in the decarbonisation plan, an ambition for half of all trips in towns and cities to be walked and cycled by 2030. But that's 9 years away. We've got like cities like Manchester. I was looking this up. I think it's got a mode share of 5%. It had 2.2 when Chris Boardman was made cycling and walking commissioner. Now he's transport commissioner. That doubled during the pandemic. And they're aiming for 10% of trips by bike. I'm not sure when, but carbon neutrality by 2038. And they've got this massive program of cycle routes. They've bought buses under the city control, or they're bringing them under control of the city to bring down prices and make it more of a network. But we don't have that nationally, which is a big problem. We're supposed to have like all cars EV by 2040. Last July to September, 8.5% of cars were EV. We're supposed to cut transport emissions by 90% by 2050. We've cut them by 1% since 2009. It's like, it's not going to happen. Like what we're doing at the moment, we're not even really trying, unless something drastic happens, unless an enormous amount of money is made. Like, who's going to have a world-class network of cycling routes by 2040? Look at like the quagmire of Kensington and Chelsea and West Sussex, which is basically like the same problem, the Shoreham Road route. They put something in. It's even like something's there and you take it away. And it's like, how are we ever going to kind of get this network? We'll have like a patchy network maybe by then. But yeah, this is not the kind of narrative that we need, because we're just going to miss it by a huge amount. Half of the 27 billion road fund is going to be for like repair, greening, biodiversity, apparently walking and cycling, but that means more than half still for new roads. Yeah, this is not the actions of a government that's actually going to do what it says it's going to do.
This is depressing, isn't it?
Sorry. No. I mean, I was just looking it up earlier because this is what people are saying. It's like, it's not enough. But then when you look at it, it's like, oh yeah, it really isn't enough. How are we ever going to do this? I don't know. Something needs to change.
I think we can learn from the last 20 odd years about how not to do it. And the worrying thing is that we're walking into the exact same like playbook. And it hasn't worked. You know, as Laura says, you know, greenhouse gas emissions relating to surface transport are the same now, pretty much as they were 20, 30 years ago. They've gone up and they've gone down a little bit, but there's been no change. And if there has been change, it's like 1%.
Yeah. Well, there's like changes in one area, and then like cars get more efficient, but then we start buying bigger cars. It's all a bit perverse.
I think we have to look at what's happened. And I found out something quite, because I'm new to all of this stuff. I've been researching what's gone before us, and you know, the roads building, the sort of fight against road building is not new. It seems new to me because I'm new to this, but you know, the kind of days of the Newbury bypass and the kind of protests around that. So I've been reading up on the act that was passed in 1998, the Road Traffic Reduction Act. And this seemed like it would be a game changer in terms of actually getting the government to, well, we're in the same issue now, right? It's a different government. It's a conservative government. It was Labour back then, but the issue was the same. You know, saying to people you need to drive less is politically unpopular, and no one wants to touch it. So to be able to get an act of Parliament passed that said the government will have to come every year, and the Secretary of State will say here are our targets for road traffic reduction. We are going to reduce car use because of the climate and environmental effects. It seems like a big step forward. But there was a clause in it that allowed the government to not give a target if they could give a reason, you know, effectively why a target was not required. So a target was never set. And every year, basically, the conversation was, we don't need to reduce car usage because technology will save us, effectively. Things will get greener. We will build more roads so that they will be less congested. So everything will be fine. And you fast forward from 1998 to 2021, and spoiler, it's not fine. And we've not moved the needle whatsoever. So to have a situation now where we're saying, guess what? We can keep exactly what we're doing, but technology will save us and we will build bigger roads so there will be less congestion. Sounds like not a great use of the last 23 years of learnings to do it again. It's really worrying because if we take another 23 years and we get to, you know, these future dates that have been set that seem like a long way away, but will all of a sudden creep up on us, it will be literally too late. It will be too late to, you know, change the irreversible effects of climate change or to even mitigate them so that humans can sort of survive. People have been dying from...
It's not like we can't do it.
We can totally do it, but we've got to be honest, I think, with the British people to start with, and there's got to be a grown-up conversation about what can and can't happen. And Laura, as we've talked about, this is possible because it's uncomfortable, and don't be wrong, you know, it's hard to deal with crises, but it's a climate emergency, we're told, and we need to deal with it in an emergency manner. And we have done with COVID, you know, we've had national lockdowns, we've had huge restrictions on people's freedom. And that was actually the only indication that we could do something. You know, the air pollution dropped, the emissions dropped, and that's the kind of stuff that we may need to do if it comes to it. If we don't, what's happening now is going to feel like, you know, the stuff we need to do now to reduce our carbon emissions is going to feel like a walk in the park compared to what it will be later down the line if we leave it too late.
What are we going
to
do,
Ned? I don't know. I'd like to hear... Yeah, I don't know. This has just been... I've been very silent for 13 minutes because I don't know. What... You say it's possible, Laura. How's it possible?
Well, I mean, we are very capable of changing things drastically if we want to. I mean, I think this period has been compared with the period prior to the NHS being formed. So there was a blueprint for a green transition, which was put together by some cross-party MPs, citizen juries, union leaders, and the Institute for Public Policy Research, which kind of blends this levelling up agenda with the low carbon agenda. And that is actually quite positive because they wanted to look at these two issues together, because historically transitions to zero carbon or attempts to change things like the French fuel duty rises led to the gilets jaunes because it wasn't felt fairly across society. Those on lower incomes were disproportionately affected. And so the theory is if the transition to zero isn't fair, that people won't support it. So one of the proposals is that there's a people's dividend, they call it, from carbon taxes, which means that areas and industries that are most likely to be affected by transition to zero would receive the most help. So it would be about like training people in high carbon industries to like retrain in low carbon industries. It would be like free local public transport throughout the UK by 2030 was one of their things. Free bus travel by 2025. And yeah, I think that maybe is like one major positive thing that's, or a positive idea that's come out. But that's very much a different agenda to the agenda that the current government's pursuing. But I think I think that's a reason for hope. And and it seems like a very kind of sensible way, because yeah, these industries that we're supposed to be phasing out if we keep pouring money into them and subsidizing them. I mean, Andy Burnham, mayor of Manchester, was saying that they've been subsidizing the bus services up there to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds. And it's like £4 for a single bus journey, whereas it's like 150 here. And it's like, yeah, this kind of public subsidization of private companies isn't really giving us the benefits that we need. And I don't know, some of the rail's been nationalized here, so yeah, across the country, so I don't know, I think maybe there's a bit of a case.
It's got to be fair, as you say, Laura. I think that's a really important point, and most people inherently want to do the right thing, but they're not, you know, they're not being led as to what the right thing is, and we've got to incentivize people. So there was a study done that basically asked people in different countries what they thought had the most impact on their own contribution to climate change. And majority of people in majority of countries thought curbside recycling was the biggest thing that they could do. And they are wrong, unfortunately. You know, it is a minuscule impact. And as we know, most of the curbside recycling gets shipped to Turkey here. And it's not having the impact it wants. So we need to have an education, because I think people overwhelmingly want to do the right thing. But we also need to, as Laura says, you need to give them something in return, and we need to make sure that it feels just. And I don't have the answer, because it's incredibly complex. But, you know, look what happened with the French government when they tried to increase fuel duty. Fuel duty needs to increase at some point. Like, it needed to increase 10 years ago. And it needs to continue to increase, because driving has become, in real terms, cheaper, where everything else has gone up in rail fare, bus fares. It's just not right. It can't be right. But they tried to put fuel duty up, and they got the Gilets Jaunes, which basically made them, over time, reverse that policy and lots of other policies. And we've had similar stuff, you know, here in history, in recent history as well. So you've got to have the boldness to know that some of that stuff will happen. But, you know, there's a whole conversation about road pricing now, isn't there, about whether that could be an option. But actually, no, we don't know if it's an equitable option. We don't know if just rich people being able to afford to drive everywhere is actually helping, because we know that it's the wealthiest people that cause the most carbon emissions. And we also... The thing that I think we're getting drastically wrong is that electric vehicles, electric cars, are subsidized middle class playthings. Really, as it stands at the moment, they are. I know I bought one. My wife got one the other day to swap out our petrol car, and you know it's £26,000, and I'm paying a couple hundred pounds a month to do it. You know, it's out of reach of the majority of people. And yet that is seen as our solution to decarbonisation. And I had to sort of wait around outside a little earlier to charge it. And there was only two charging bays, and it was in use. So I went into Lidl. I didn't even want to go to Lidl. I ended up buying Nutella and all sorts. Nutella's got palm oil in.
Oh, that's where you got your
well.
Influence.
Like, anyway, sorry. Going off topic.
I come back to my original question about, do we need to travel? And I'm not entirely sure that I was completely happy with your answer, Adam. Although I do accept entirely what you said about human progress and human society and human fulfillment and desire, and you know that inbuilt urge to go forth and to experience the world is part of our lives, isn't it? And I you know, being very hypocritical here, because I've travelled a lot in the course of my work up until COVID, and I feel incredibly denied having missed out on what I considered to be my right. But you know, we do still have, going back to the practical concerns of choked up roads and massive congestion and lots of emissions being belched into the sky, there is still a phenomenon in our towns and cities. And now I'm not just talking about London, I'm talking about Coventry, I'm talking about everywhere. Grantham, Lincoln, Bedford, you know, you name it.
They're all tall Britain places, aren't they? That's the only places you know now. That's our London.
But every, you know, Monday to Friday is when you get rush hour, right? School holidays and weekends, you don't get rush hour. The numbers of people jumping in cars on a working day, Monday to Friday, that's it. If you can crack that nut about people commuting in their cars from their home to their place of work, you could make a big dent in the numbers of vehicles on the road at any given time. So I come back to that question of, you know, do we need to be in an office?
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying there, Ned, but I also just want to clarify that I'm not saying we should keep the status quo, to be absolutely clear. People should still be able to travel, but we need to change the way we travel. You know, the majority, you know, in London, there's 50% of car journeys, 3 kilometres and under. In the whole of England, it's nearly 60% of car journeys are under 5 miles. Those journeys, we should still be able to go and see our friends. We should be able to go to the pub. We should be able to go and get employment. We should, you know, go and meet new people. But we should not be doing it, you know, in the private motor vehicle. That's the key.
And what we need to get rid of is the hateful journeys that make people spiteful and angry. And, you know, I think most people hate their journey that they do every, you know, Monday to Friday. You know, there's that famous cartoon, isn't there, with the man getting furious to the, I'm sure you know the one, that dates right back to the 1950s about how it changes his character getting behind the wheel of a car. And it's those, I mean, there's a lot of human misery wrapped up in this. And a lot of that is simply shifting your carcass from your home to your place of work in the morning. So it's those, I completely accept. My mum and dad, up until very recently, lived in Scotland. Sometimes the only way of getting there is to drive. But I travel with joy in my heart because I'm going to go and see my parents. That makes sense. That's a kind of act of personal freedom that I would no way want to deny everyone. But what about the stuff that people resent, you know, in their lives? So that must be the starting point.
Well, there is talk about 15-minute neighbourhoods. And I think one of the ideas is that we won't have to go into these kind of centralized offices anymore, that we'll have kind of co-working spaces and that we'll be able to go. And it will be a bit like working from home, but you'll be working with people, not necessarily from your company, but yeah. So you don't have to have those horrible journeys. Cause even, you know, getting on a train, also pretty grim if you're in one of the busy commuter routes, like shoved into like a sardine can. Yeah. And I think having more kind of localized services would be a big help as well, and would cut out a lot of that kind of going into the city centre, which then raises questions about like what all those buildings in the city centres, like London, all of these new skyscrapers that have gone up, what they're going to be for. But yeah, I think there's, I don't know, people like me who work flexibly anyway, that's kind of how I would like to see it. But I'm sure there's plenty of people. I know someone who works for a very small business. They actually gave up their office, so now they're permanently working from home, which is not an ideal situation. But yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of people who could work from these kind of little neighborhood hubs, be good for local shops, local high streets. We talk about high street regeneration. It's another brilliant thing about that kind of idea. Don't need to have those kind of hollowed out commuter towns anymore.
Even if it was 2 days in five or 3 days in five, think what an impact that would have.
It would be we need to be careful though, not to just look at this through a kind of middle class lens. We all have jobs that we can do from that point of view. And the majority of people, you know, if given the choice, they wouldn't travel to work at 5 a.m. to work on the trains, or to, you know, to work in an office building or whatever they need to do. And yet, of course, some of those jobs can be done elsewhere, and we've learned a great deal about that. But you know, I'm comfortable. I'm here in my spare room converted into an office, and that's great. But I've got staff that are live in, you know, a three bed flat with 5 other people, and
yeah, you're,
you
right,
know, sit on the coffee table isn't an option in that respect. So we do need to be a little bit careful, because people will always need to
you're right, Adam, and I totally accept that. And there are jobs, clearly there are many millions of jobs you can't do from home. That's kind of an accepted point. I was thinking about the millions of jobs you can do from home. And I think you're absolutely right to talk about the home environment not being a place that everybody can rely on, and that's incredibly presumptuous. But then that's where Laura's notion about the local hubs comes into play, and that's really, I think that's really enlightened thinking, and could, as you say, regenerate the local high street rather than another thing that should be penalised and scrapped and just not happen any longer is the out of town retail park, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, that's another incentive to create a traffic jam, and it's another reason why town centres are crumbling.
Yeah.
We need to link in decarbonisation across all of those things as well. So what you've just said, Ned, is basically planning, isn't it? You know, it's not transport, it's it involves transport, but it is a different, in the council, it'd be a different department. In the government, it's a different department. And we need to,
absolutely,
need to make sure those things are, you know, are connected. And those 15-minute neighbourhoods, I think, should be the... And the government are talking about them in the right way. But, you know, we're building houses now that we know will cost more to retrofit later because, like, no one's willing to stump up the cost to do it now. These are the kind of, you know, conversations we need to... When I went to Gelderland province in the Netherlands, I went and spoke to their city planners, and they actually... Basically, they're paraphrasing and you know, doing it for effect, but their politicians in that province basically passed a law relating to the climate that they can no longer do stupid stuff, even if they've already paid for it. And basically, that means that, you know, if they've decided to build, extend roads and things like that, then, you know, it's the wrong thing to do. If they've got a multi-story car park on the drawing board because they want to do it, can't get passed. And we need to have those big, bold conversations, because we're gonna waste, you know, some pretty precious time, I think, and we can waste some pretty precious time with those red herrings as well. And that's what worries me about electric cars. You know, we have this a lot in Coventry because we have a huge motor industry in this part of the country, and I'm finding myself as an active travel advocate having to have a lot of discipline because we have one car as a family. It's my wife's car. We sometimes do some long journeys. She has travel an hour and a half once a week and a few other things. It's not a train service. So now I've got a car on the drive, and I know it costs barely anything once I've paid for it to travel. You know, I charge it up for an eighth of the price of a tank of petrol and use it for short journeys and pretend that I'd be guilt-free when I, you know, I shouldn't be, but that's how you feel when you hear how quiet it is. And I have to stop myself. I have to say, Adam, it's a short journey. Ride your bike, walk, you know, follow what you've learned. And I'm an advocate for this stuff. And if we all have electric cars, we're going to be driving even more miles because it's just too damn tempting and they're too damn comfortable.
I was having quite an interesting chat with someone earlier, actually. In Coventry, actually, they've got this thing where you give up your gas guzzler, your old diesel, and they'll give you kind of points or
they give you £3,000 in mobility
money.
Credits. Yeah,
I think it's £3,000 for bus travel, and it's like helping people to change their behaviour, get rid of their old cars, and also car sharing can be quite powerful, or like getting businesses to sign up to car clubs instead of having their own car parking, and stop giving their employees pence per mile, because that's basically incentive to drive. There are quite a few kind of behavioral nudges. So I was talking about this for an hour.
I think mobility credits are great. They need, you know, it's only a pilot in Coventry, but I think that's going to be a big part of our future. And just so you know, that £3,000 can also be spent on, it can be spent on buses, it can be spent on trains, it can be spent on car sharing, it can even be spent on taxis as well, and bike share. And that opens up a whole load of possibilities for people that have those old gas guzzling vehicles.
Yeah, and apparently for every one car share car, you can get rid of like 12 cars.
Yes, yeah, exactly. People getting rid of the car is the hard thing, right?
Get rid of their car. Don't just swap it for an electric one. Then people's behaviours change, because it's kind of a sunk cost, isn't it? A car, once you've got it, you think, well, I may as well make the use of it and like drive a quick trip down to the shops. But yeah, that's not what we need to be doing. So.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Well, this we've gone from deeply depressing, world-ending, literally world-ending stuff, to glimmer of hope through the people's dividend and all of those things, because that's, you know, that I don't think that's happened before.
In order to feel optimistic about this, I think you made a really good point a short while ago, Adam, when he said actually it's not a transport issue, is it? Or it's not uniquely a transport issue. It's across every single department of government and every area of our lives. This is the biggest, you know, this is the biggest challenge, you know, as you say, it almost makes COVID look insignificant. So this is huge. And we need to stop considering it. It's a health issue. It's an economic issue. It's you know, and I think those points you made about planning and redesigning our environments is absolutely, I think front and center of what we need to be doing. So yeah, I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic than I was 20 minutes ago.
Yeah. I think the thing just to wrap up is that keeps me going, but also worries me at the simultaneously is humans are we have boiling frog syndrome, right? So like stuff happens slowly, and we're like, this is fine, and then someone ramps it up, and we're like, okay, we need to do something about climate change, and that's happening right now. You know, it feels like half the world is on fire and the other half of the world is flooded, and that's scaring people. And people, you know, haven't seen these once in a lifetime events are now happening, you know, once a month, and it will soon be once a week. And when it really gets to us, you know, I think wrongly, but like if you say to someone the temperatures are going to be so high that food production, you know, in Africa is going to be really struggling and there will be famines, that is awful. But from people who work in that sector, no, it's quite hard to get people who don't have that on their doorstep to relate to it, because, you know, for all different psychological reasons, however bad that is. But when it starts happening here and we start to really, you know, I don't know, I can't cope with it being any hotter. It's been pretty hot recently, right? If it gets any hotter, I'm not going to be able to, you know, like joking aside, I will be able to cope. But it's going to start to get really damn uncomfortable, and our freedoms and stuff are going to have to start getting restricted. And I think at that point, we've seen during COVID that people can change drastically. And I just wonder what it will take to get them to change at the speed and urgency that the scientists know that we need to.
Hear, hear, Adam.
Well, we've got COP26 coming up, haven't we, soon? So who knows?
Yes, we'll probably have the red arrows going over the top or something. To...
the electric red arrows.
Maybe.
All right. Well, is that it? Laura, do you want to give us a sign off? Because you introduced the show at the top so brilliantly. I want to see if you could just give us a very professional answer.
I just want to be like you, Ned. I want to commentate on the Tour de France next. So watch out.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Streets Ahead. Let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate us and review us and share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it. And we will catch you next time. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.